Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This time we begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard it before, and there's always a few people joining it, we give a little bit of an introduction as to what is the TechNet. It's a gathering of curious people who have more than just curiosity. They really want to know how things work with reference to radio, antennas, transmission lines, and Hall effect devices, dipoles, and transmitters, and receivers, and propagation. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. So if the one you're using doesn't quite please you before you give up this extremely educational hobby, make sure you try one of the others. This will be TechNet number 1575 of the group of TechNet meetings that began on Sunday, September 1982. That makes it 33 years ago. We'll also be hearing tonight Space Report number 168 by Paul WS2N, our space expert. You'll be hearing from John KC2WGB, who handles the mailbag. He also monitors the Echo Link. I call it website. I think it's not, but you know what I mean. He monitors Echo Link, so if you have trouble signing in by way of Echo Link because we don't leave a long enough pause between the transmissions, John will know about it. Let me drop him. Along the way, from time to time, we hear from Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience with a lot of electronics, and he claims to give the more brief explanation to my more verbose explanations. And some people like a little bit of each. TechNet's been around a long time. People sign in from many states, a couple of countries, Canada in particular, and so it's developed a bit of a reputation as to a way of getting answers, that everything you're going to hear is always 100% accurate. By way of the peer review process, we eventually find out the truth. By peer review, I mean there's a website where every one of the TechNets are recorded. That's at amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Stand by. That website is run by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. Occasionally you'll see a week's worth of recordings on that particular website where there's an error in the recordings and it doesn't play back to you. But Mike eventually fixes that, so just hang in there. Something in the vicinity of 3 or 4 days after each individual TechNet session takes place, you'll find a recording there. Mike has about 9 years worth of recordings there now. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and the recordings are in 4 reels of 1 hour each, so you can play back all the past TechNets. That helps some people quite a bit because the TechNet itself runs from 8 o'clock until midnight. Some people have to go to work the next day and can't stay up that late. By way of the recordings, they can put that recording on their portable machine, whatever kind it is, and play those recordings back as they're driving to work, as they're on the train, as they're on their noon hour, or whatever. So there's lots of ways you can get a hold of it. There's another very useful website with reference to the TechNet, and that's LimogTechNet.com. So Mike 1 and Mike number 2 run those two websites, and a lot of good information is there. Past articles that have been published, pictures, and things like this. So, a person who is about to sign into the TechNet, let me drop. He does that because he does have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. Way back in the very beginning, we used to have long lists of people signing in saying they're listening. After 33 years and a few awards that the TechNet has won, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, you can save your breath, so to speak, and save us some time. So if you do really have a question or a comment, give us your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which is a confirmation that you do have a question or a comment. So, give me those sign-ins right now, K2RIW listening.
And 2EO, November 2 Echo Oscar with a comment to the net.
Would you recognize anyone else?
Kilo 2, Juliet Alpha Sierra. Kilo 2, Juliet Alpha Sierra. Yes, Roger, I have a question.
Okay, K2 Juliet. Roger, we got... we got Roger, we got Richard. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Delta 2, India Ox, India X-ray Papa, John, yes.
Okay, we got you. India X-ray Papa, with a slightly sticking mic. We got you, John. So we got Rich, Roger, John. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
And that's 2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening.
Very fine, Paul. And Eric, what's the weather like tonight? I took a quick look earlier and it was kind of overcast. Do you think there's a chance of seeing that that full eclipse of the moon tonight at around 9 o'clock? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Got a clear view from Staten Island, Dick.
Yeah, I think you'll have no problem, Dick. And I just quiet. I'm looking at the moon. Just a little bit of overcast. How about that?
It's very clear from Rockaway.
Okay. So N2MB in Rockaway. Barry says it's clear. John says it's clear. Eric says it's pretty clear through the clouds. So it looks like there'll be a nice eclipse of the moon, full eclipse of the moon. And this is one of those super eclipses where the moon is at its perigee, closest to the moon, closest to the sun. Here we go, closest to the Earth you're ever going to get. That makes it something like 13% larger and full eclipse. Eric, do you remember the exact hour in which... Well, first of all, does anybody know the hour in which it begins and when's the hour of the middle of the event? Anybody with that information, give me your call letters right now.
WS2N.
Yeah, our space report man, bet you he knows when it's going to start, when it's the middle, and when's it going to end. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, the eclipse actually begins at 12:11, and then partial eclipse at 1:07. Full eclipse. Now these are UTC times. Maybe I should give this. We're on Eastern Standard Time. Let me go with Eastern Standard Time. Let's worry about the local people. 8:11. It starts officially. Partial eclipse is 9:07. The full eclipse is 10:11. Then they call it the max. The max is 10:47. So a little bit before 11, and then back to full at 11:23, back to partial at 12:27 a.m. after the net, and the very end completely gone at 1:22. So look for it between, I would go between 9 and 11, you know, looking at 10 to 11 is the best time. Back to you, Dick.
What direction in the sky is it? Yeah, I think it's soon after moonrise to the east. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead, Paul.
I see the moon is up in the east now. So there you go. So it's only a matter of time that's going to start rising higher. I don't have the degrees, but it'll probably be, you know, 50, 60 degrees. Or maybe higher. Perfect there. Alignment pretty much. Back to you.
Paul, you're seeing the moon to the east right now, and each fist outstretched at full arm length from the bottom of your fist to your top of your fist is 10 degrees. Make me a rough guess. How many degrees above your horizon to the east is the moon right now? Paul, go ahead.
Just cut a couple of trees down right over there, and that was, I would say, two fists, so, and that was, well... half hour ago before I just came in for the net, so you're looking at 20 degrees, 25 maybe by now.
Okay, somewhere between 25 and 40 degrees, and the moon moves 14 and a half degrees per hour. The Earth turns 15 degrees per hour. Moon moves very roughly 14 and a half degrees per hour. So you count the number of hours from now at 14 and a half degrees to each one of those, and you'll know roughly where it is. So, sounds to me like it's going to be fairly high to the, basically to the east. And so we don't even have to worry whether it's that high in the sky. I don't even have to worry about finding a place where you can see the moon real close to the horizon. Sounds good. One last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Other than the people we've already gathered, give me your call that is right now. K2LIW.
N2DDD, November 2, Delta, Delta, Delta.
Mr. Delta, Delta, Delta. Sounds like you've got a question or a comment. Please tell me your name.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Name is Jose Mova on the Queens side. And the question was matching. I don't really understand matching, especially on a mobile. You have some antennas that you can put the antenna in the middle of the car on the roof through a hole, and it matches fine. And some of them, especially the quad band antennas that we have for some of the radios, the instructions mentioned that it can only be done through one of those adapters in the back door of the car, or else if you put it anywhere in the car, it would be impossible to match. So I don't really understand why would that be.
Okay, I was just asking for your name, Jose, and there's a couple of people ahead of you, so we take them in the order in which people sign in. So we'll get to your question on matching. It'll take us a little while. Maybe it might take us a good 3/4 of an hour, so I hope you'll be able to wait in there that long. Rich, N2EO, I do tell that you've, after many years of absence, you're back on 40 meters by way of that beautiful fractional length dipole thing, the Cobra that you're using, fed with open wire line and antenna tuner. So you've had two QSOs on 40 meters. I bet you they've said, it's about time to come back to us. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. N2EO, yeah, you must listen all day. I'm sure you heard it. Yes, it's working very, very well. I want to give you guys a critique on this because anybody who wants one, it's well worth the money. It was about $100. I bought it from Gene, W2KJI. KJI Electronics in New Jersey. He shipped it to me in Massapequa Park. I would recommend Gene to anyone and everyone. He's the one that first told me about it. It's made by a company called Cobra Compact Antennas. You can look it up on the internet, Google it. Cobra Compact Antennas. They make three. The longest one is 200 feet, which is too much for me. That one goes down to 160 meters. One I bought is 73 feet long, fed in the center with open wire line, and covers 80 feet. And if you don't have the room for that one, make another one, which is like 40-something feet, covers 40-something. Very nice. I'm so happy with it. If it came down and broke, I'd buy another one. That's how good it is. And, Dick, I want to, I've been on 40. I made two contacts today. One to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Another one to, Philadelphia. And during the day, you don't get the, long propagation. You get short propagation. Because the D layer is still in the atmosphere. So, I was holding my own. I was surprised. They sent S9 to me, and they told me I was S9 to them. So that's really the story. The antenna's about $100. It's well worth the money. And Dick, I want to thank you and Barry for stepping up to the plate, coming over and putting it up for me. I think most people know, maybe not everybody. I'm an amputee, I'm in a wheelchair, and I got other problems, so I couldn't do it myself. And just to critique you guys, Dick, I know you had a colorful career. You worked on the lunar excursion module, you worked on the B-1 bomber, and you picked up signals directly from the moon. When you were working for Airborne Instrument Laboratories, you set up a dish and a low noise amp and a receiver on both the 2 gigs, and they picked up the astronauts directly on the moon. And Barry N2MB is, I know Barry like over 40 years. close friend. And I want to thank Barry also very, very much. People should know, I mentioned it in the past, I'm very proud to know Barry. He's an ex-military man. He was in Vietnam, and he was a lieutenant. Most people who are draftees never make rank, maybe sergeant. Barry made it all the way up to lieutenant, and they wanted him to stay in. The colonel said to him that if he stayed in, he'd make him a captain. But Barry was worried his luck would run out because he'd have to go back for another year in Vietnam. And he didn't want to do that, and I don't blame him. Anyway, that's what I got to say. Guys, check it out. Cobra Compact Antennas. Very nice. Over to you, Dick and Julio.
Yeah, this looks like a dipole, except that it's made out of a Stucci version of the four-conductor ribbon wire that goes to a rotator. That's what it looks like. And by wiring the individual wires together on the ends so that it becomes a kind of a fallback structure, it resonates on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. So when it's resonating on 80 meters, even though it's only 73 feet long, it acts like an antenna that is 133 feet long. That's the full length of a half-wave dipole in 80 meters. When Barry and I strung that up between two of his trees, Rich's two trees were, I'm going to make a guess, 85 feet apart. They wouldn't have had the length for a full 133-foot dipole. The 73-foot dipole fit between those two trees very nicely. Let me drop. And Barry sunk a screw eye into the tree, all in the vicinity of 40 feet up on the tree on the northern side of his property and the southern side of his property. And we strung a piece of braided nylon rope through those screw eyes, brought the rope down to another fastening much lower on the tree on both the north side and the south side. Nylon rope is fairly stretchy, so that extra length of rope, the rope on each side is probably 20 feet of rope on each side. So he's got a 20-foot long nylon spring, so to speak, by way of the rope being pulled through that upper screw eye. So his trees will sway, and most likely the antenna will stay up. If not, repair should be pretty easy. So as you can tell, Rich is quite happy with that antenna, and for the time being it's doing what he needs, and it has very little visibility. In other words, we amateurs see wire when we look up in the air. Neighbors looking at wire in the air, they don't see it for a very darn good reason. Every 150 feet down every single residential street, you've got utility poles with a zillion wires on it. So our population doesn't see wire. So you can string antennas like this, one for north-south and one for east-west. You can fill up the air above your property with wire. And no matter how many antennas a ham radio operator has, there's never enough. You always need another one. Sort of like a boat operator always needs a bigger boat that can sleep more people. Sounds like Rich just got a happy situation there. Good luck with that one, Rich. Roger was next, K2JAS. Roger, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
The manufacturer of that antenna for a quick one, WJT.
Cobra Compact Antenna. I'm guessing the name of the company that makes it is Cobra. Is that true, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
Partly. There's a lot of companies, if you go on the internet, that say Cobra, including CB Radio. So you want to put in the full name. Cobra Compact Antenna. Skagit.
Cobra, like the CB, C-O-B-R-A?
That's right, but it has nothing to do with CB. Put in on Google, Cobra Compact Antennas. You come up with their website, and I don't know who else sells it, but Keen, W2KJI in New Jersey, and KJI Electronics has it. And if you don't want to go there, it's too far. New shipping. Yeah, Dick.
Very fine, Rich. Thank you for that extra information. Okay, Roger. Roger comes to us from Sayreville, New Jersey, I think it is. Wait a minute, I got the... Oh, Morganville. Morganville, New Jersey. He's down the road a piece. Let's see. He's 56 miles from me. That probably means he's 35 miles from the repeater. So what's going on in Morganville, New Jersey tonight? Roger, K2JAS, K2LAW in Texas.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everyone else. This is Roger, K2JAS, and the question is this evening. I have a Kenwood TS450 rig, and I also have a Yaesu Fox Tango 901 Delta Mike. Talking only about the TS450, I would like to be able to monitor my own audio. So if I put in the processor, I can hear exactly what the difference is. And when I try to monitor that audio with the other rig, with the antenna disconnected, all I can, I think I'm just overloading it. And is there a better way to monitor one's audio? Because, let me drop it. It seems that hams these days are very much concerned about their audio to the extent that I think it's somewhat ridiculous that they're looking for broadcast quality, FM broadcast quality on the DX bands, and that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. So back to you, Dick. This is K2JAS.
Harassment. That's a tough one. What you're trying to do, Roger, is not easy. I'm going to give you some words as to why. Almost every radio receiver you have ever used, between the antenna connector and the loudspeaker, there's a little bit more than 120 decibels of gain. That's a big number. In other words, if you look at the voltage that went in and the voltage that came out, and that ratio is a 10 to the 12th power, 120 dB. When something's got that much gain, it's intended to look for weak signals. By the time you and I send our 100-watt signal out of our dipole on an HF frequency, or a 30-watt signal on 2 meters out of its antenna, by the time it gets a few miles away, the first mile gives you 90 dB of loss on 2 meters. And maybe it's only 85 dB. It's in that neighborhood. After that, it only goes up 6 dB every time you double range. So as you get more than a mile away, the signal gets weaker, but very slowly, and it gets slower and slower. Obvious by what happens with that 6-watt signal from the Voyager spacecraft, 12 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto. And that 6-watt signal goes through that 12 billion miles, takes 17 hours at the speed of light to get here, and with a real good healthy antenna out at Goldstone, California, that 140-foot diameter dish, and as long as the signal is coming through a slow enough in bit rate, like 50 bits per second, that's DX, 12 billion miles with 6 watts. That's got to be a record. It's a real good record. So what I'm getting at, let me drop. Is the receiver is all set up to listen to a signal of microvolts. And when you're in the same shack with the transmitter, you're getting many volts. And when you go from a microvolt to a volt, that's 120 dB. That's 60 dB of, let me think now. Microvolt, that's a million to one voltage ratio, which is a million squared power ratio, if you know what I mean. So you overload the receiver like crazy. You can get away with FM. The magic of FM is that although the early stages of the receiver are being saturated like crazy, because the saturation can create amplitude distortion, but there is no frequency distortion. There's no way that the transmitter under the receiver under normal conditions, even under overload, can change the instantaneous frequency of the signal. Therefore, after that highly distorted, heavily overloaded signal goes barreling through your receiver, your FM receiver, and the limiter stage levels out all the amplitude distortion and now only looks at the frequency deviation. So in, you can take a handy-talkie with earphones on it, so to speak, and even though the two of them are a foot apart, you can monitor your own audio with an FM receiver that's being overloaded like crazy. In the case of sideband, oh boy, you can't do that. Let me drop.
Give me a 100 dB pad.
The 100 dB pad that Eric just suggested might not do it, because the leakage signal from your transmitter coming out of the case, coming out of the power cord, the 12-volt lead and whatever, that leakage signal coming out of the case could easily be 10 dB stronger than the signal you put through the 100 dB pad. But When it comes to trying to measure very weak signals, let's assume now that I had a receiver, and there are a number of receivers, commercial receivers, that have a sensitivity of minus 140 dBm. And you look at any normal signal generator, and you turn the dial all the way down to the bottom. Rarely do they go below 120 dB, minus 120 dBm. And you're looking for measuring the sensitivity of minus 140. So you'd say to yourself, well, I'll just put a 20 dB pad in there. You do that, and you'll get some really peculiar response, because the leakage of the cabinet of your Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, for instance, will be considerably louder than the signal that comes through the front panel connector plus your 20 dB pad. The way the guys get around that, when you're trying to measure real weak sensitivity, they call it the New England technique, because the guys in New England first invented it. You know that the cabinet's going to be leaking. The cabinet is a QRP type signal. It's around minus 100 or 120 dBm, if you know what I mean. It's a leakage. And because the first 50 feet or 20 feet of spacing is going to give you 40 or so dB of loss, you put the signal generator in the backyard, you run a long coax cable from the backyard, and maybe through that 20 dB pad, into the shack, and you have a guy in the backyard on the other end of a handy-talkie, or maybe you're shouting to him with the open window, you're telling him how to set the dial and to measure the sensitivity. So the leakage from the cabinet is now getting weak real fast because you've added this extra distance, and now the major...
Repeater, time out.
I'm going to check to see if we've got... Yeah, we've still got the eastern repeater. Now the main signal the receiver is going to get with that extra 20 or 30 feet of spacing with the signal generator in the backyard, the strongest signal the receiver can get now is the one that comes down the cable. So you can measure sensitivity with the so-called New England technique. Therefore, you could measure signal sensitivity by that technique by putting your receiver, I'm going to pick a number, 20 or 30 feet away, and it's well shielded. Maybe the receiver is looking at a dummy load, or the transmitter could be looking at a dummy load. A lot of guys will think that if they take the transmitter, put it into a dummy load that's well shielded, and now the receiver nearby should pick up that signal. Oh, yes. But where is it picking up the signal from? Is it the leakage from the coax cable that's 115 dB down? Is it the leakage from the cabinet that's around 115 dB down? And now you're not quite sure which one of the stages of the transmitter is leaking through the cabinet. Are you listening to the final stage that's being amplitude modulated correctly? Are you listening to an earlier stage of the single sideband generator? When the two pieces of equipment are in the same shack with you, side by side, unless you've got an extremely well-constructed anechoic chamber, screen room-like thing, where you put the receiver that's going to listen to the signal in a very well-shielded room, you put the transmitter into another very well-shielded cage, and now you've got a coax cable between the two with a great big pad. The leakage of the cabinets, when you're talking about the huge number of dBs, really dominates, and it gives you crazy results. And if you try listening to your own sideband signal, you hear all kinds of fancy feedback squeals and whatever. So the best I could recommend is extra distance. The best way in the world would be to talk to somebody who's got a receiver that you trust. Let me drop. He's maybe a mile away, and he plays back the signal to you over a real good FM repeater, over the telephone, whatever technique. So as you can tell, by one means or another, you've got to have extra distance in there, Roger. There's almost no other way, because the leakage of the cabinet, the leakage of the cable, you're really pushing the state of the art. A very well-shielded piece of double-shielded RG214 cable. That's the double-shielded version of RG8, with very well-installed type-end connectors. I would only trust that to 115 dB of shielding on a good day. Any receiver has 120 dB of gain in it, if you know what I mean, so it can easily be overloaded just by the leakage from the cable if the receiver and the transmitter are very close. So by one means or another, you've either got to have super shielding between each of those devices, or you got to add the extra distance. It can be done. Don't give up. But now you know what you're up against. That receiver is made to listen to microvolt and fractions of a microvolt signal, and you're giving it, the transmitter is giving you hundreds of volts, and the difference between the two is just a huge ratio. You can overload the living daylights out of it. Nobody can build an automatic gain control circuit that could tolerate that, if you know what I mean. So I think you're starting to see a little bit about what you're up against. And what you saw is exactly what you're supposed to see once you understand the physics of it, Roger. Darn good question. Lots of guys have run into this problem. And they'll say, how come I can monitor myself in FM and I can't do it in sideband? K2JIS, K2RIW in the tech net.
But the sample, just very quickly, because it's K2JIS, I know exactly what you're saying. It's making a great deal of sense. I was just wondering, is there a way to the audio level and not the RF level? Because I see in a lot of photographs, these people have equalizers, and they're cutting highs, they're cutting lows, they're boosting mid-range, whatever. But how are they monitoring themselves is the question.
If you really had the schematic diagram of your rig, and you looked at the audio circuit, and you put yourself a 1K resistor that taps into the last stage of audio that goes into the sideband generator, and you brought that out the back panel with a separate connector, and now you put that audio into some kind of a audio monitoring system, earphones, oscilloscope, spectrum analyzer, audio spectrum analyzer, whatever. So without a doubt, you could tap into the audio before it goes into the sideband generator. However, once it goes into the sideband generator, a sideband generator, usually it's a kind of a doubly balanced mixer, is the way it's often done. And if it wasn't set up just right, it could have a little bit of crossover distortion, could have a little bit of flat topping reaction. All of the stages of amplification and frequency translation within the transmitter chain, and the final stage of the transmitter itself, depending on how well the tuning and loading control is set. In the old days when we had a real tuning and loading control in the Pi network of the final stage of the transmitter, modern-day no-tune transmitters, you still have a automatic leveling circuit in there. Is it working correctly? Does it have the right attack time? So there's a zillion ways that all of the stages of linear amplification between that sideband generator and the final output connector on your transmitter, there could easily be 10 individual stages, any one of which could give you some kind of distortion. So making sure the audio, let me drop. Making sure that the audio with its equalizing circuit, the audio being fed into the sideband generator, making sure it sounds the way you want it to, that brings you halfway home. Doesn't bring you all the way, because all of those other, let me pick a number, 8 or 10 stages of RF linear linear amplification and frequency translation, all those other stages of filtering and whatever, your sideband network after the sideband generator has got a filter that's trying to select the upper sideband and reject the lower sideband and reject the carrier. And depending on whether that filter was 2.1 KC wide, 1.9 KC wide, 2.8 KC wide, depending on its skirt selectivity, depending on its group delay distortion, its flat topping characteristics, in other words, an ideal filter, particularly one that's got digital signal processing, could give you very clean audio. Another kind of filter could give you very high punch audio that allows you to get through a pile-up of a DX station. It could give you that kind of audio. But if you're having a nice long rag chew with somebody, that kind of heavily filtered and heavily voice speech clipped filter audio might not be what you're really looking for. And so, as you can tell, there's a lot of other things that can happen. You're right. You're on the right path, in my opinion, here, Roger, to want to know what it really sounds like in RF output. And the audio that goes into the sideband generator, that's only the first half of the story from my point of view. K2JIS, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, there's about two comments. I think EJ and John were in that order. EJ first, go ahead, Eric.
All right, two things. I understand perfectly what you're talking about. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever looked at some modern transceivers that disseminate on the flex connector, other than the pretty good, actually. But my real comment is you can get an SDR dongle, and actually, if you want, you can record record the entire 20-meter band at one time, okay, and you can place this device, which has really large antenna in front of it, put out, let's say, down the block, record the entire 20-meter band. In fact, it does actually have sideband modulator. And as you're commenting, all of the things that change the characteristics of the audio recovers is even different than the manufacturer's method of recovering audio in the start of your pager.
Eric, that dongle-like device that you just described, what brand name, roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Eric.
There's a Zillion brand name. If you go to itl-sdr.com, find the software that you need to make your dongles work. Dongles are based around two chips. There's a couple different forms. The actual dongle itself, I bought mine for $12. I paid DVB dongle, which is the video standard in Europe, takes the satellite audio band. Some of them go from 2 megahertz to 2 gigahertz. Gotta look. And there's also a lot of guys out there make these little up converters that go from 2 megahertz to bring it to 60 megahertz. Sorry, WK2.
Very fine, Eric. Nice information. Thank you. I think the other person was John, KC2WGB. How did you solve this problem, John? Over to you.
KC2WGB. Yes. Good evening, Dick. Similar with testing test equipment, what I've done in the past, because you have the same basic problem, is I have 6 mil aluminum foil, which I can encase the receiver and the transmitter in. Pretty good Faraday and a pretty good isolation, and you can make measurements that way. It seemed to work fine with me. I'll use a little BNC or L259 with a small loop on it. You may even want to have that protrude past the aluminum if it's required, and run your transmitter at a very low power, and you can make those recordings. You're right, that leakage current can kill you. But just another idea. But that thing Eric's talking about is a good idea also. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Wes, did you have a question on this?
Yeah, I spoke to John last night and said that there is no perfect Faraday cage. Nothing strange. But the Faraday cage is designed for a very much certain frequency bandwidth, and you are in within that frequency bandwidth. And you have the instrumentation to sense the signal, and the power is set up to the spec of the transmitter or that is inside the Faraday cage. Perfect. And to XG.
To JAS. Okay, Roger, recognized. Every shielded room, every screen room, and I worked on arguably the most expensive screen room that I know of in the United States is the one at Wright-Patterson, Edwards Air Force Base in California, near Camarillo, California. No, it's not Camarillo. I'll think of the name of the town pretty soon. Not too far from Palmdale, anyhow. That chamber is 1.5 acres of floor space, 7 stories high. The walls are made out of quarter-inch thick steel plates, where all the plates are very carefully welded together, and they did magnafluxing to make sure there's no bubbles in the welds, and it's got a double shielded door and whatever. That room is guaranteed to be 100 dB tempest proof, and it goes way beyond that. In other words, a broadcast transmitter outside that room, you put a super sensitive receiver inside the room, the signal you're going to get inside the room versus outside the room is more than 100 dB weaker. You're about to say, well, it's going to be below the noise. Oh, really? When it comes to the signal coming from the Voyager spacecraft to the Earth, that signal is experiencing something like 290 decibels of free space loss because of the range. Could you make a screen room have 290 dB of shielding? I think you could say the answer is absolutely positively not. No matter what you do, there's a skin depth of penetration of the RF energy through that copper wall. and although the signal is falling off very fast with every 10,000th of an inch of copper, it still does not go to zero. You transmit a radio signal out of your transmitting antenna. Let me drop. That signal that you transmit goes to every single cubic meter of this universe in every possible direction. You can't stop it from doing that. That radio signal goes everywhere in this universe. I will admit that if you're behind a hill, 50 miles away, inside of a well, if you know what I mean, and inside of a screen room, you can make it weaker and weaker and weaker. It never goes to zero. The only thing left to discuss, you give me a sensitive enough receiver with a big enough integration factor, a narrow enough noise, a narrow enough effective noise equivalent bandwidth, a low enough data rate of the signal, the right kind of back-end signal processing. It might use Reed-Solomon signal processing, similar to what's going on with weak signal Joe Taylor. No matter what the conditions are, if your back is against the wall and you use all the tricks in the bag of tricks of a good RF engineer who knows how to design transmitters and knows how to design receivers, no matter what the condition is, he can set things up for you that you will receive that signal. If you built two of those screen rooms that are at Edwards Air Force Base, one inside of the other, now you've got, in theory, 200 dB of shielding. You give me the right conditions, I will measure that signal inside of that room. So the thing that people think is that, oh, I've gone beyond the range of my radio. The signal can never be recovered. Under those conditions, with that particular receiver, let me drop it. Those conditions, that particular receiver, the answer is yes. You change the conditions. You make sure you've got high enough spectral purity of the transmitter. That means you really know the frequency it's on. You know the exact nature of the modulation. Hopefully it's a very slow modulation rate. I mean, when it comes to sending a signal through seawater, the most conductive fluid you and I know is seawater. You use a high enough power at a low enough frequency, like they're doing for quite a few years, you're able to transmit signals to your submarine anywhere in the world under seawater, something like 120 feet down. With the right kind of receiver, he will get that signal. So you cannot stop a radio signal. You and I can discuss how many decibels we attenuated by. The number of decibels of attenuation never goes to infinity in dB. That's a fancy way of saying the absolute magnitude of the signal never goes to zero. It gets weaker and weaker. And now you can define, if you've got enough background experience, you can define how weak it's going to be. You can never make it go away. Ain't that crazy? Be happy it is that way. That's the magic of radio. The signal always gets there. What's left for you to do is design the right kind of equipment to receive it under those weird conditions, under those very severe conditions. Anybody have further questions on that one? It's a good one. K2LIW in the TechNet.
One question, K2JS.
Go ahead, Roger.
I can't speak for all radios because I've only used this one. But when I put my headphones on, I cannot hear myself when I'm speaking. In my airplane, when I put the headphones on, I can hear myself when I'm speaking. What is the difference?
I don't know the answer to that. In the case of the airplane, where there's a whole lot of background noise of that wind going by, maybe you're using sound-canceling phone. That may be a factor. And maybe it's a much better set of earphones. If you give me a set of earphones that's playing back my audio, with or without audio delay, and if you make the audio in the earphones loud enough, you will always hear your audio, as long as it's really there. So, if you couldn't hear your own audio, under that particular condition, maybe that...
Ground radios have a monitor circuit.
Okay. The monitor circuit helps an awful lot, but what I'm getting at is, if you're receiving your signal from the... that's not being overloaded. So if the audio is really there, and if the audio is loud enough in those earphones, you're going to hear it. In fact, if you set the audio too loud, you'll be afraid to speak for fear of damaging your hearing. Back to you on that, Roger. K2IW.
Okay, K2JAS. All right, so someone says there's a circuit, and that seems to make some kind of sense. I don't know what you would call that, side tone or... or something, but I'm not aware of that kind of a circuit in single sideband equipment. Certainly aircraft is AM, and yes, I am using a noise-canceling headset, but even if you turn off the noise-canceling, you still hear your voice as you're speaking. I think we've killed the object, or beat it to death, so please move on, and I thank you very much for this very interesting explanation. K2AS.
One last thing, Dick. My plot on these cage radios, I have a monitor to the radio so you can hear me.
Your audio below, I can hear it. See what you said, maybe Dick can repeat it for you. Eric, give us a little more audio and please repeat what you just said.
Some radios, like the Asus that I have, they're a bit older. They actually have a monitor position where you plug your headphones and hit the monitor button. You hear the audio that you're feeding into the various different modulators. You don't hear the output of the radio because you would then have to demodulate it. So, but some of the radios do actually have a monitor position for the audio path up to the point of modulation.
I understood 100% that my Yaesu 901DM, it does have a switch for monitor, but not the Kenwood, and I was just wondering, have I missed something here? But I think we beat it all to death. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do appreciate it, and I'm going to go take a look at the moon. K2JIS.
Very fine with that project, Roger. Come back and let us know what you see. Now, after my 40 years of experience as an electronic engineer, much of that for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, some of that as a private consultant, but almost all of that I'm working with radio circuits. Of all the radio books I've ever read, all the radio courses I've ever taken, this concept of radio, that once you transmit a signal, it goes to every single cubic meter of this universe. Anything left to discuss is how long it takes to get there, how weak it will be when it gets there, what kind of equipment you're using, whether or not you'll be able to receive the signal, but the signal is there. That, to me, is a absolute truth. Everything that I've seen, all of that years of experience, have confirmed that for me, and Voyager is the best confirmation I can think of. 12 billion miles away with a 6-watt QR piece. 6-watt. 6-watt QRP signal after all of these years of that thing working since 1937. That to me is a beautiful definition, a beautiful example of the fact that that signal goes everywhere. As I said, to me it's an absolute truth. I have never read those words in any of those books. I have never heard those words in any course I've ever taken. I've never heard those words from another engineer. I've heard things close to it. As I said, I believe it to be the truth. You can see what it's based on. And yet, for some reason, it's not taught to people who are learning radio. It's one of the many things that's not taught. The way we teach antenna design also is highly lacking from my point of view. Those who teach it are stuck in the paradigm of the way they've been doing it year after year, and they're not willing to adapt. They don't give the information to the engineering students in a useful engineering form where they can go out and actually really do it. You want an engineer to design antennas for you, you probably have to choose a guy that's had at least 10 years of apprenticeship under the white-haired guy who is the antenna design engineer in a good company. And if he survives that introduction to the subject after 10 years, maybe you've got an antenna designer. It doesn't have to be that way. It's a huge lack in the educational process from my point of view. You might not agree with me, but you can see what it's based on. The next person who was in our list was John. I think it's K2IXP. I know it's IXP. I'm just not sure if his prefix is Kilo 2. But K2IXP, question mark. K2RIW, you got it, John.
Y2HF for comment.
Okay, go ahead with your comment in Y2H. Dennis, go ahead, Dennis.
Dick, just a query. Why haven't we heard, with all the radio arrays we have on Earth, why haven't we heard anything from some of the other galaxies or planets? You know, it's hard to believe that we're just alone here on this rock. Missing it, or do we not have the sophisticated radio array to to gather up information from the universe. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I know where you're going on this one, Dennis. And this is a pure speculation on my part. My speculation is there's a huge amount of life out there. I mean, the Stanley Miller experiment, the Miliuri experiment, you looked that up, Stanley Miller, way back in 1956, he found out that if you take the raw ingredients that were on the Earth and you put them into a flask and pass a spark through it for a week and bubble it just right, all the amino acids, a high percentage of the amino acids will form. The strong implication is that life is universal. In other words, you wait long enough, life will eventually crawl out of that flask, is the implication. So we have good reason to believe that if a planet's in the Goldilocks zone around a nice star like ours, and there's zillions of them out there, there's got to be a lot of life. Now, are those guys out there, have they decided that the best way to communicate is by radio? For all we know, they've decided the best way to do it is with fiber optics and light. And radio is something that they skipped over, or they decided that's not good enough for them. Or maybe they're transmitting gravity waves. So whether or not they're using radio that you and I respect on the frequencies that we know about, and they decided to transmit a signal in our direction. Let me drop it. Because the distance between the stars is so huge, that nearest star to us, our next-door neighbor, Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri, 4 and a fraction light years away, at the fastest you and I could transmit a spacecraft, translate a spacecraft out there, would take thousands of years to get there. That's the very closest star. And there are stars out there that are billions of times further away than that. So in order for somebody to send us a signal that would be above the threshold of the equipment that we're presently using, they'd have to be transmitting gigawatts of signal into a high-gain antenna aimed exactly in our direction. And what would make them decide to do that? I mean, if they've got that kind of resources, do they really want to send a radio signal to us to let us know that we're there? I mean, it would be a huge investment in the electricity price, so to speak, and equipment and whatever, and what do they get in return? Will their Congress let them do that? I mean, if you and I right now went to Congress and saying that, gee, I've got this great project. Dennis and I want to build this gigawatt transmitter with a 1,000-meter diameter dish, and we want to aim it at that particular star that Kepler found to us. Kepler has found thousands of stars going around planets, but of the six so planets that he has found so far that are Earth-like, you and I have chosen one of those that's 50 light years away, and if we invest 50 megabucks in this project, and then get funding for the next 10 years to transmit a signal in that direction for the next 10 years, and it's going to be 50, because it's 50 light years away in my example, so 50 years for the signal to get there one way, another 50 years to come back if they hear it and if they feel like responding to it. As you can see, let me drop it. I know what 99% of those congressmen would say to us if we said, I want that to be funded. And if you could get somebody like Bill Gates to dedicate a few $1 billion of his money to that project, I think you could do it. Although even he would say, what are we going to get in return? There's a hell of a lot of disadvantaged children in Africa that I could be giving computers to as opposed to this particular project. So as you can see, it's not difficult. Lack of evidence is not evidence of them not being there, Dennis. It's a difficult project, even at the speed of light, long distances, long amounts of time. So don't give up the project. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is going on. We're getting better and better at it. There's all kinds of things we can look for to confirm the life, and we're trying to confirm those things right now. But the fact that we haven't heard a signal, I wouldn't be discouraged. It would be nice if we had the great big QSO in the sky already, but it's going to be a while. I'd like to believe you and I are going to live to see that one, Dennis. NY2HF for any of the comments, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XGN comment.
Good explanation. I guess really what we have to do is just wait, because time is on our side. Sent the signals out, we have to wait for them patiently to get back. Not us, maybe it's the next generation, but somebody's going to hear something somewhere along the line. We've got to be diligent. Back to net.
There's a continuous progress going on that's not obvious. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for a while it was funded by NASA, and now it's not. It's now privately funded. But slightly better antennas are slowly being developed. But where the real breakthrough is going on is in digital signal processing. Remember that signal from Voyager, 6 watts, 12 billion miles away. You have to listen to that signal way up there at 8.5 gigahertz, 8,500 megahertz. Under normal conditions, to listen to a signal that high in frequency, you'd have an IF bandwidth of something like a megacycle wide in order to just find the signal. Because that signal is so weak after all that distance, that receiver has to have a bandwidth of 50 hertz. A 50 hertz bandwidth receiver with a small fraction of 1 dB of noise figure in the front end connected to a 240-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna in Goldstone, California, precisely aimed at that spacecraft. And that spacecraft has an 8-foot diameter dish with a 40 dB of gain aimed precisely at the Earth to the nearest fraction of a degree in order for that communication to take place. So you've got this extremely sharp flashlight on Voyager. Thank goodness their electronics is working very well, and its positioning accuracy is that well, that it can aim a very narrow flashlight at the Earth. And the Earth has this similar great big dish capturing that signal. You put all that hardware together, and yes, that distance can be covered. Now, the SETI people are realizing that with good digital signal processing, let me drop. You'd like to have a receiver with 1 hertz of bandwidth, so you have super sensitivity. But now where the hell are you going to put that 1 hertz of bandwidth? No matter where you put it, there's a 99.999% probability of a lack of intercept. In other words, they're transmitting on this frequency while you're listening on that frequency, and you're a megacycle away using a 1 hertz filter. Okay, the solution to that is to build the electronic equivalent of millions of individual channels to the receiver, all 1 hertz wide, or all 10 hertz wide. With real good computer digital signal processing, you can build that receiver. Some people call it a rake receiver. Other people have got other names for it. But you can build a very broad-range receiver where each one of the individual channels has super sensitivity. We haven't done that yet in the past. You carry that process far enough, good antenna, good low noise front end, and real good digital signal processing, you will eventually be able to hear the leakage of the local oscillator of their receivers, if you know what I mean. It doesn't even have to be an intentional transmission, as long as you make the sensitivity high enough. So once we start pulling out all the stops along these lines, our SETI receiver sensitivity is going up by orders of magnitude every decade. When Frank Drake first did that listening in roughly 1985, with that 85-foot parabolic dish that had just been installed at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Maybe he did it in 1965. I think it was 1965. The receiver sensitivity we're using today compared to what he had then were probably 100 decibels more sensitive today than he was then, because he was using a conventional receiver on a good-sized dish that had just been installed. So,
repeater, time out.
So, with that trend, and I see just like Moore's Law tells you that you're going to double the number of transistors in an integrated circuit chip every 18 months. Every 2 years, you're going to double the number of lines of code in your state-of-the-art computer and so on. You can see the trend in greater and greater sensitivity for SETI-like searches, Lee searches, low emitter, I can't even think what Lee stands for anymore. I used to work on some of those receivers. So, good news is coming, just nobody knows when. I think Wes had a further question on this. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. You are touching human limitations to the space being you there exist. But the light is an electromagnetic wave. And a human being is able to receive and see and process electromagnetic waves. So, there might be beings that don't have that limitation as much. There is a bacteria, at least from April 25, 2011. It's a group of physicists.